We are in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 23. We've just taken a look at Amaziah, the king of Judah. Amaziah had a pretty prosperous rule. He was able to subdue Edom. But what happened immediately after he subdued Edom? You can look it up, okay? We'll stretch everybody's memories. This is your pop quiz for what happened last week.
He had a battle, sent home, what was it, 100,000 men that he hired?
Right. Remember, he was going to go to Edom, and he had hired 100,000 mercenaries from the northern kingdom of Israel. We're in 2 Kings chapter 14. Well, no, that was the king of the north. That was actually, if we look at our timeline, that guy that only had 10,000 left was Jehoahaz. Okay? Now, he's gone, and his son Joash has taken the throne right about the same time that Amaziah takes the throne. And Amaziah is able to defeat Edom in a major battle. He kills 10,000 Edomites in the battle, and then he takes 10,000 of them up to a cliff and throws them off the edge. Just for good measure. Before that battle, he did try to hire 100,000 troops from the northern kingdom, but God sent a prophet and said, you don't need them. I'll help you win your victories, so send them home. So he sent them home. And what did they do on the way home?
They
ransacked several villages along the Judean-Israelite border. Took some captives and generally wreaked havoc because they were upset that they weren't going to take part in the battle. Well, Amaziah is victorious in the battle, but what else does he bring home aside from a little notch on his belt that he was won a major victory?
Idols.
He brings home Edomite idols, and he begins to worship them in Jerusalem. And he tries something else shortly after that battle. What is that? Dan? That exactly is the question. Why would he do that? Because exactly. You just demonstrated that those idols are powerless, but reason doesn't always convince the sinful human heart, does it? It wants to worship an idol, it's going to. And so he brings the idols home, sets them up in Jerusalem, begins worshiping them, and then in his pride of his newfound victory, what does he try to do? He sends a message to Joash, the king of the north, and says, hey, let's have a little tournament. Let's face one another in battle. And do you remember Joash's response? Yeah, right. So it's that little parable. A thistle tried to marry the daughter of a mighty cedar tree, and then a hog came by and trampled the thistle. So basic idea is you're overstepping your bounds, Buster. Get back down there where you belong, or harm is going to come to you. Well, does Amaziah listen to that? Nope. He goes up. They meet in battle anyway, and what happens? Joash wipes the floor with Amaziah. So much so that Amaziah is captured in the battle, escorted back to Jerusalem. Joash tears down about 200 yards of the Jerusalem wall on the most vulnerable side of the city, in effect saying, you got nothing. So stay home. And then he leaves. Well, the only encouragement that he gets is that Joash dies very soon after that battle. That gives us a little bit of dating information. So if we know that Amaziah took the throne here in 839 BC, just about the same time as Joash did, Joash rules for 16 years, which brings us to here. That means this is the latest that that battle could be, and that's about halfway through Amaziah's rule. And in fact, the text tells us that he lived for 15 years after that battle. Okay? So the writer of the Kings is giving us some good chronological information about what's going on here. And so we know some of the things that are going on and about when they are happening. So when we pick up in verse 23, we can pinpoint some of these dates. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. So if Jeroboam takes the throne in the 15th year of Amaziah, that's right here, That means that the battle that Amaziah had with Joash probably happened just a year or so before Jeroboam took the throne. And then Joash dies and Jeroboam takes the throne. Well, that means we can look at the history that's following here. And as I said this morning, the next seven verses cover the life of Jeroboam II of Israel, which is not a whole lot of space given to Jeroboam, but it is highly, highly impacting events that happen under Jeroboam's rule. So let's take a look at them. Jeroboam, he began to reign, and he reigned 41 years. That is a long rule for the kings. Most of the kings average out to be like 18 to 20 years or so, but Jeroboam's got a nice long reign. Verse 24, how does he do, good or bad in the sight of the Lord? He does bad, because what does he continue to do? Right. He doesn't depart from the sin of the Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he led Israel to sin. So Jeroboam's sin was establishing those two golden calves, one at Bethel and one way up north in Dan, where the Israelite people would falsely worship what they called Jehovah, but it wasn't actually Jehovah that they were worshiping, because they weren't worshiping according to the Mosaic law. Well, every northern king has continued that same practice all the way back to the beginning of the divided kingdom. And we are talking 160 years now this has been going on. You realize we are in now the third dynasty. No, maybe the fourth. Let's go back and count them. I forget. So Jeroboam the first is the first dynasty. His son Nadab is killed by Baasha. So that's the second dynasty, Baasha and Elam. And then Omri takes over, so that's the third. Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah, and Jehoram. And then Jehu kills him, so Jehu is the fourth dynasty. And Jehu's son Jehoahaz and his son Joash and his son Jeroboam. So, this is the fourth dynasty of the northern kingdom, but every one of them has maintained that false calf worship that's going on. They haven't departed from it, and every single king gets this condemnation from the Lord. They did evil in the sight of the Lord by allowing this to continue. They should have led the people back to the right worship of Jehovah according to the Mosaic covenant, but none of them do. Verse 25, he restored the border of Israel. Now here's where things really start to get interesting, because we have to remember back to our history who had been harassing Israel. Syria. Okay? I'm going to scroll north on my map just a little bit so we can see what's going on. It always seems to be when I move the map that the computer freezes up on me. Okay? Don't move the map. Syria, their capital is Damascus right here. They own a whole lot of land up to the north and over to the, what side is that? The east. But they have, over the last 25 years, under the leadership of two men, Hazael and his son Ben-Hadad, they have expanded, they conquered most of the region around Galilee, they conquered all of this land over here called Ramoth-Gilead, and they even made a foray south down to the Philistine territory of Gaza and Ekron, and at one point they even penetrated as far in as Jerusalem and attacked Jerusalem. But the king of Jerusalem at the time sent them money and said, hey, please go away. So they did. So we find Syria occupying this horseshoe shape all around Israel, and that leaves the northern kingdom of Israel smashed right here in the middle, having lost most of its former terrain. And that's where we saw Jehoaz down to 10,000 troops at the end of his rule. Well, his son Joash was able to defeat the Syrians three times, according to the prophecies of Elisha. Thank you. So Joash was able to beat the Syrians back a little bit, but now we're going to find out that Joash's son Jeroboam takes the battle even further. And he continues to move it backwards. So he restores the border of Israel from Libo Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant, who? Who's the prophet? Nope. Jonah, the son of? Well, it says there, in verse 25, Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath Hepher. Does the name Jonah ring a bell?
Yeah.
Who is it, Tim? Yep, same guy. This is fun. Because how many of you have read through the Old Testament histories and then you get to the prophets and you're just like, what in the world's going on here? You don't understand the historical context around them because in our Bibles, we've separated them. I mean, Jonah, here we are in 2 Kings, and you have 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalm, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah. We're like 20 books removed. So if you're reading through the Bible in the order it's printed in your Bible, by the time you get to Jonah, you've forgotten all about everything you read in the book of Kings. And you don't notice some of the historical connections, but here it is. We are specifically told that this is the time when Jonah, the man who was swallowed by a whale, lived during the reign of Jeroboam the second of Israel and his contemporary in the south, Amaziah. So Jonah, who went and prophesied to Nineveh, we talked a little bit about what happened there. Nineveh is the major world power. It is the capital of Assyria. Assyria's empire over here is where it began, but they have conquered the region of Babylon. They have stretched north and conquered the Hittite empire, and now they are pressing southward against the Syrians. What happens when you fight a two-fronted war? You lose, right? Almost every time you lose. It's very difficult to fight a two-front war, which is why we look through history and say, how amazing that God worked in the Axis powers for Hitler to make that monumentally foolish decision to attack Russia. If he had not attacked Russia, we probably couldn't have beaten him. Because if he'd have gone much longer, England was down to just about a dozen airplanes and maybe two or three functioning airfields. And Hitler makes a couple of major decisions. He decides to start bombing London instead of military targets, and he decides to invade Russia. Two crazy military strategies. They're foolish militarily. But God was at work to make sure that Hitler did not succeed in what he was trying to do. And God uses mediate works. That is, he uses people to accomplish his goals and ends. And so in the case of Hitler, he used some of these crazy decisions to give England respite and time to rebuild and give us time to get over there and move all of our troops to England and then begin the invasion. When you're talking about ancient history, Assyria is in this period of rapid expansion. What stops it and gives Jeroboam time to build the kingdom of Israel? Syria's between them, but honestly, Syria is not standing in this war. They're getting attacked from Israel on the south. They're getting attacked from Assyria on the north. But a certain man named Jonah travels to Nineveh at the command of God and preaches a message of repentance. And how do the Ninevites respond? Really well. They repent in sackcloth and ashes. And Jonah's really upset about it. But even the king repents. The king of the largest country in the world turns from his wicked ways at the preaching of Nineveh, and the country stops. They stop their massive expansion. They stop their wicked practices for at least a generation. It doesn't last much longer than that, but it allows God to accomplish his purposes with Israel. So Nineveh stops expanding, and that gives Jeroboam a chance to accomplish something. And it says that he spread his border as far as Libo Hamath, as far as the Sea of the Arabah. So let's zoom in just a little bit. Ephraim, the kingdom of Israel, is right here. Damascus, the capital of Syria, is right here. Anybody see the town of Hamath? way up north here. This is Hamath right there. Jeroboam pushes the border of Israel back up through Bashan. He conquers Damascus, passes Riblah, and all the way up here to Hamath. He restores the border of Israel. Another interesting thing that happens here is we know from extra-biblical archaeology that there was a period during this time when there was no king sitting on the throne of Syria. Okay, Hazael that Elisha anointed, and his son Ben-Hadad were the two that have been conquering Israel all this time. They're gone. And now there's what's called an interregnum, meaning there's no king sitting on the throne of Syria at this point. Why is that? Because they've been conquered by Israel. They're under the dominion of Israel, and apparently Jeroboam II doesn't give them the privilege of calling themselves their own country. Sometimes when a king conquered another country, he would let them continue to call themselves a country, let them continue to have a king, as long as the king behaved himself and sent tribute every year. Heavy taxation was the way to keep conquered countries in line. Well, apparently Jeroboam doesn't see fit to do this, and he reduces Syria to a territory of Israel. And there's no king ruling over Syria for a little while. Well, not only does he push as far north as Hamath, but he pushes to the Arabah. It says the Sea of the Arabah. Now, does anybody see anything about the Arabah? You're probably not going to see it because it's way down here, hidden under Edom. This is the region of the Arabah. So not only does Jeroboam push far, far north and take over Syria, he also comes down this side of the Dead Sea over in Ramoth-Gilead area and through Moab, and he conquers all the way down here to the northern edge of Edom and puts that under Israelite control. There's some other things. Verse 26, "For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel was very bitter. There was none left, bond or free, and there was none to help Israel." That's a description of the state of things before God brought Jeroboam onto the scene. It was bad in Israel. Remember when we saw the description, there were only 10,000 troops left? This nation had been so heavily attacked that they were about ready to be wiped out. Is that a problem in God's plan? To wipe out Israel? No? Maybe I'm asking the question unclearly, okay? Is it part of God's plan to see Israel wiped out? Ever? No. Why not? Did he promise? The chosen people? The promise? Which promise? The Abrahamic covenant, okay? Your descendants will be as the stars of heaven, okay? And some other promises that God says, I'll never leave you or forsake you. The Mosaic covenant. All of these covenants promise us that there will be a people of Israel into eternity. And so to have that nation wiped out at that point would have been a real problem. So verse 27 says, "But the Lord had not said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven." In other words, it's not just that God forgot to say this. The meaning there is that God said it would not happen. Okay. So he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now, think about this. What is God saying? God is using who to save Israel? Jeroboam. Is Jeroboam a faithful guy? No. Not at all. Is he even a good guy? No. Not very. But God's going to use him? Does God use wicked people to accomplish his purposes? Oh, yeah. Yes, he does. Crazy as it sounds, God is not bound by our wickedness in that way, and he uses the wicked and he uses the just for his purposes in accomplishing the history of this world. Okay? And that's where the text kind of starts to finish up the description of Jeroboam's rule. Verse 28, "Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did and his might, how he fought and how he restored Damascus and Hamath to Judah." Now what do we know about Damascus? No, it's the capital of what country? Syria. And Jeroboam restores it to who? To Judah in Israel? So Jeroboam's helping Judah? Isn't this interesting stuff? Okay. Are those things not written in the books of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Jeroboam slept with his fathers, the kings of Israel, and Zechariah, his son, reigned in his place. So, short description of the rule of Jeroboam the second, but it has huge, huge impact. Jeroboam rules for 41 years, and under his rule, Israel becomes the most powerful nation it's ever been since the time of David. Now, David had borders far larger than what Jeroboam extends to, but this is the largest the northern kingdom of Israel has ever been, and it all happens under this rule of Jeroboam the second. There are, however, some other interesting things that are going on here. And we got a few minutes, so we'll play around with them. Since we've covered the basics of Jeroboam's rule, let's have some fun and start doing some math. How many of you love math? One of my engineers even didn't raise his hand. It's obvious. Okay. Okay. Has anybody ever sat down and tried to trace out the histories of the kings of Israel time-wise? This is a really fun... I know you've done it. You did it with the pre-flood people, right?
Right.
Did you do the kingdom of Israel?
I got lost.
You got lost, yeah. The kingdom of Israel, especially when you're talking about the divided kingdom, is where a lot of scholars just kind of throw up their hands and say, oh, forget it. What's the point? Because there are some really interesting things that go on here. How many years between... Well, let's get some relative dates here. When was the Exodus, roughly?
A long, long time ago
in a galaxy far, far away, right? That's rough. That's very rough. Let's get a little finer on our location there. It was just a little... Yeah, just a little under. Eldon?
I got everything down to, I don't remember what the years was, but I got everything down year by year all the way down to the building of the temple.
Okay.
And then after that, I lost.
Okay, that's really interesting too, because the building of the temple is one of the very specific dates that Scripture gives us. Because it tells us that the foundation of the temple was laid in, do you remember what year? The 480th year after the Exodus. It's one of the temporal markers that the Bible gives us. Because wouldn't it be nice if God had inspired these B.C. writing authors to put in their dates that we recognize, like in the year 786 B.C., Jeroboam II. It didn't happen that way because they didn't have a calendar that went up to the time of Christ yet, right? But they are recording these things down in detail. One chain, one link leads to the next. So when Solomon builds the temple, they're able to say it's 480 years after the Exodus to the very day that he founds the temple. And so that gives us a date. We know it's 480 years from the Exodus to the building of the temple. Well, if we can put together some other things, we can try to fill in some of these blanks. So the next major date that we generally go to that's pretty easy to find is the destruction of the temple. And almost completely universally recognized to have happened in what year? A couple people that disagree, but we ignore them. Anybody know the year of the destruction of the temple under the Babylonians? Nope, not 700. You're thinking of a different event. 586 B.C. You got it, Daniel. Exactly. Right. 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar comes in, destroys Jerusalem and the temple. Well, if we start there and we work our way backwards through the kings, it's a little easier than starting with the founding of the temple and moving forwards. But if you work backwards through the kingdoms, you have an unbroken chain of kings from the destruction of Jerusalem all the way back through to Solomon when he builds the temple. And you can trace those and you can put the years together and it works really well. The trick is, when you put the northern kingdom with that, trying to line those two timelines up. One of the problems that you run into is right here in this passage, because we get some interesting things that go on. So, we've already been told that Amaziah lived 15 years after the death of Joash in the northern kingdom. So if Joash dies here, 15 years, that's including this year, you get to 29 years of ruling for Amaziah. And that means Uzziah, his son, would have taken the throne right here, right? Well, if Joash is succeeded by his son Jeroboam, and Jeroboam continues along with Uzziah for a while, Amaziah, until Amaziah passes away, then what year of Jeroboam would Uzziah take the throne? Right about the 15th year, okay? Because Amaziah lived 15 years after the death of Joash. So that would make sense that Jeroboam was on the throne for 15 years when Amaziah's son Uzziah takes the throne. But I want you to look at chapter 15, verse 1. How many years has Jeroboam been on the throne? 27. Okay. In the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, the son of Amaziah, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 16 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. Something's not lining up. Because if we take the descriptions of the northern kingdom, this should be Jeroboam's 15th year, but it clearly says there it's the 27th. So we got a 12-year discrepancy. How do we account for that? Okay, so yeah, it says 2 Kings 14:17, which says Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, had lived 15 years after the death of Joash. And it says 2 Chronicles 25:25. So let's go ahead and check that out. 2 Chronicles 25:25. Okay. Both of those verses say the same thing, that Jeroboam was on the throne for 15 years, that Amaziah lived 15 years after the death of Joash, which would seem to indicate that Jeroboam was on the throne for 15 years when Uzziah takes the throne. So, how do we answer this? Here's how many scholars answer the question. There's an error in the text. We don't know where it is, but somehow there's an error in the text, and that 27th year is the wrong number. How do you handle that objection? What do you think? Got any thoughts, Eldon?
Yeah. There's something there that we don't know.
There's something we're missing.
Right.
Okay? But you don't think there's an error in the text?
I don't think so.
Why not? I mean, the math clearly doesn't work out. It can't be the 27th year of Jeroboam and the 15th year of Jeroboam, can it? He came to the throne twice. Interesting. Tim?
He was a pro-rex.
It's possible. Okay. Here's the issue, though. I bring this up to point out that the answer a lot of times, even among people that we would otherwise consider good, solid biblical scholars, is to resort to textual problems. Here's the trouble with saying there's a textual problem here. You know how many of our Hebrew manuscripts vary at this point? None of them. Every Hebrew manuscript we have says 27th year of Jeroboam. It's a different story when you have a couple of manuscripts that say one number and a couple that say another number. Then you do have to get into saying, well, one of them must be in error. But the great thing about the Hebrew Old Testament is that the Hebrew text is very much intact for us. It hasn't changed. There are many fewer variants in the Hebrew text than there are in the New Testament text. Okay, so and especially when it gets to these numbers. So if they start to claim that there's a textual problem here, they're making it up. There is no textual problem. So the Bible's in error, right? That's our only answer. Either the text is wrong or the Bible's wrong. It got the date wrong. Or, Eldon, your answer was?
There's something we don't know.
There's something we don't know. That is a valid answer, isn't it? When you're talking about scholarship and studying anything, there is always room that I don't know all the answers. Hannah?
My John MacArthur notes say that Azariah had an old, like, one of the kings had an 11-year co-rex reign with their father.
Mm-hmm. That's the other solution that a lot of people go to, is that Azariah or Uzziah must have had a 12-year pro-rex situation. The trouble is that the wording doesn't really say that. It's possible, but when you're looking at the wording of what goes on there, it doesn't seem to be that that's what happened. It's possible. The other trouble is that, okay, if I have an unbroken string of kings and the lengths of their reign from the founding of the temple to the destruction of Jerusalem, what happens if I move Uzziah 12 years this way? What happens all down that chain? Yeah, if I take 12 links out of my chain right here and I move everything down, I've got problems the rest of the way down and nothing will line up. That's the trouble of inserting here a pro-rex situation. There is one pro-rex that we know of, or actually co-rex. Pro-rex is accounted differently. There's one co-rex that we know of, and that's Jehoshaphat and his son. And Joram is his name. He has about an 8-year co-regency with his dad, but the text tells us while Jeroboam was still king, his son took the throne. The text doesn't say that here. Now, there are some interesting things going on there, because how did Amaziah die? Anybody remember how Amaziah dies? Let's go back and check that out, because it's fun. Okay, 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 18. Now the rest of the deeds of Amaziah, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? And they made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem, and he fled to Lachish. But they sent after him to Lachish and put him to death there. And they brought him on horses, and he was buried in Jerusalem with his fathers in the city of David. And all the people of Judah took Azariah, who was 16 years old, and made him king instead of his father Amaziah. He built Elath and restored it to Judah after the king slept with his fathers. So, the narrative there doesn't seem to indicate that there was any co-regency. There may have been a time when Uzziah was ruling in the place of his father, but his dad was still king and still he died. And most of the time, when we're talking about the Judean kings, they didn't start accounting a king's reign until his father had passed away. And the only exception that's clearly stated that way, otherwise, is Jehoshaphat and his son. So, is there another answer? It's still possible that there was a co-rex situation, but as I said, that's going to throw off everything else down the line. So, are there any other answers that could interject themselves other than saying the text is wrong?
Sure, I'll think of one.
You'll think of one later? Okay. That'll be your homework for next week. We're a few minutes over here, but for next week, ponder this. Pull out a sheet of graph paper. See if you can add everything up with all the reigns. You know, compare your books of Chronicles and your books of Kings, and because I know you guys have nothing else to do during the week, right? You know, maybe for your devotional time, crunch some numbers this week, and see if you can come up with a solution to our problem here. We got a 12-year problem. We'll see if we can find it. Okay. Any questions? No theories on answers.